Hello, everyone. Welcome to the binary half of the podcast for this week. I'm Spectre with Mia Z. As always, before we get into our topics, we'll cover the Spot the Bomb challenge for this week. So Z, I'll let you take that away.
Yeah, so this week's was a bit more of a web challenge. And this is something I've kind of fallen in the trap of doing before, but when I'm looking at code, you'll see there's kind of this split here between a little bit of MySQL and a few lines of PHP, where I'll look at code and I'll see, okay, good, they're using a prepared statement, they're binding it and executing that prepared statement in the PHP, so everything's secure. The problem is that, you know, as usual with SQL injection, you want to avoid like concatenating strings together. So the problem here is they're feeding in that bound parameter, but in the actual prepared statement, the spget messages. And I will apologize now for using a username. When I was building the challenge, I had a database that I was querying against, and I forgot to change username to a more appropriate column name for a function like get message, but the issue is still there regardless. So the issue being that it creates this query variable and literally just concatenates whatever that bound parameter is into that query and then executes that newly created query. So it's still doing that same string concatenation. It's just happening in SQL instead of happening in the PHP where you would usually see it. So it's a straightforward SQL injection, you know, put a single quote in there, you'll break out of the existing single quotes. Nothing fancy needed there. Just kind of need to realize that just because it's bound doesn't mean it's secure from injection.
Yeah, and I mean, like some of the guesses that we've seen, it's really easy to like think the issue is more complicated than it actually is, like overthink it. Just because, like you were saying, like when I see a prepared statement, it's easy to think like, okay, there's not going to be like a trivial injection bug here. Add that onto the fact that you have to look into the query to like spot the issue, and yeah, it's somewhat simple, and you would find it easily in testing, like live testing. But just looking at the code, it can be a bit tricky to spot. So it's a cool challenge. I like it. But
Yeah, and I will also give a shout to Sir Apocalypsis, who mentioned if you pass in the percent, you'll get all. Good shout on that. In this case, I feel like, you know, you're getting feeds by name. The wild card might be more of an intended thing, but it's definitely a good thing to consider, as that is kind of the side effect of using like versus using something like equal. So, good point on that.
Yeah. And with that said, we can move into our topics for this week. So we'll start off with some news. Tianfu Cup ran last week, which is the China equivalent of Pwn2Own, although calling it equivalent is perhaps a bit downplaying Tianfu because the stuff that comes out of there is way more impactful, typically. You'll see a lot of like mobile and whatnot there, where Pwn2Own, you'll see a good deal of soft targets like IoT and routers and stuff. Tianfu's targets are things like browsers, Docker, operating systems, hypervisors, iPhone and Android phones specifically. There are a few routers in there, like the Asus AX56U, but generally there's a lot more hardened targets in the list. And you'll see a lot more submissions on those targets, whereas Pwn2Own teams typically tend to hammer in on the softer targets. So
well,
Tianfu,
I mean,
is usually
to be fair,
more interesting for me to see what comes out of it.
I think it's worth being fair to Pwn2Own. A lot of that shift kind of happened closer towards just when China stopped allowing their researchers to participate in something like Pwn2Own and instead need to become a more local event. You know, this taking place in China, the Chinese researchers can participate. It seemed like with that, Tianfu Cup kind of became the competitive place to go and unveil these attacks or vulnerabilities and all of that. So like, yes,
for sure.
Now Pwn2Own has kind of, I feel like it's lost a bit of that prestige that it used to have because of the fact that a lot of the more higher impact vulnerabilities are coming out at Tianfu Cup instead. I do just want to be fair to kind of the legacy of Pwn2Own, though.
Yep. No, I agree. That was a big blow for Pwn2Own, was losing the Chinese teams. But Yeah, I mean, they have a lot of hardened targets. There's typically some pretty impactful stuff that comes out of it. That said, there's probably a reason for that, because there has been some news stories circulating the last year or so that indicates Tian Food Cup is basically a zero-day farm for the Chinese government, whereas Pwn2Own is more for vendors. It's more targeted towards them. And the research behind that, with indicating the Tian Food Cup exploits end up in the Chinese government hand, is the fact that exploit chains used found in the wild were found to be developed and used the Tian Food Cup. So that's been a bit of a drama around the like competition for the last little bit. So I did think I'd bring it up quickly, since I did mention the hardened targets and stuff. A few interesting hacks did come out of it. For example, the fully patched and newest iPhone, being the iPhone 13 Pro, running iOS 15, was exploited in some capacity at least 3 times. It's not really detailed on their website. Unfortunately, the Tianfu website does not have a lot of information at all, but there was a post in The Record that included some screenshots or some images from the event and has some translations. So the main thing I'll talk about here is the little listing they have of different targets. So Windows 10 had the 5 exploits, Ubuntu 20 had 4, Chrome and Safari had 2 each. And the top 3 winners of the event were awarded 650K, 520K, and 390K, respectively. So there's also a lot of prize winnings that come out of Tian Food Cup. The prizes easily exceed over $1 million, which, you know, isn't too surprising given the nature of what's being shaken out of it with these mobile exploits and stuff. That's a big market. So yeah, I mean, Tian Food Cup is always a good thing to look at to see the modern security landscape and whatnot, see the state of various software and products and where they're at. I kind of said it before, but events like Pwn2Own and Tian Food Cup can be valuable to companies to see how they're doing with their security stance, see like where they might want to improve on. Tian Food Cup doesn't really help as much there because, like I was saying earlier, the information doesn't really get back to the vendors the same way. And there's not as much public information either. Like ZDI, you'll see a lot of blog posts throughout the year that come out about stuff that was submitted to Pwn2Own after it's been patched. Tian Food Cup, you just don't really get the same insight, unfortunately. But even just the raw numbers of seeing like what's being targeted and the payouts and stuff is somewhat interesting to cover. But yeah, don't have too much more beyond that, just because Tian Food Cup doesn't really have any information out. I found it really interesting, actually, because I looked at their Twitter, and last year they were tweeting out pretty actively during the event, talking about, like, you know, when certain things were being submitted and whatnot. But this year their Twitter was basically dead. They didn't really have any tweets for the event. So I don't know if they didn't really care about the public facing aspect of it as much this year for some reason. But yeah, the Tianfu site doesn't have like anything on the event. Not even, I couldn't even find the rankings on their site. So it's a little bit strange, but
yeah, I mean, this is about as much information as you're able to get.
Yeah. The big story coming out of that, though, is the like the iOS chains. Apple's like iOS is one of the most hardened targets out there, if not like it's one of the top 2 hardened targets. I'd say Android and iOS are like at the top. So being able to pop it 3 times when it like literally just came out, that's pretty significant. So there was some news stories running with that. Anyway, we can now move into some exploits that we actually have information on. So we'll kick off our exploit section with 7 vulnerabilities discovered in Windows, 6 of them being privilege escalation, and one of them being an info leak. This was put out in a technical write-up by Field Effect. It includes a lot of background information on Windows kernel I/O, definitions and stuff, and how TOC2 vulnerabilities work. In the interest of time, since there is a good deal of bugs here, I'm going to skip covering all of that on the podcast. But if you want some of that background information, you can find the PDF in the description if you're interested in giving that a read. It is very thorough with covering what you need to know. But the important takeaways that I will quickly cover is, if you're not familiar with Windows iOctals, they kind of have 3 different modes for handling I/O. They have buffered I/O where it'll copy the user data into kernel memory, which is the most safe. That's typically how it's done on a lot of operating systems like Linux. Direct I/O where user mode buffers are locked in memory and mapped to a kernel address, and neither, where the driver receives the original buffers and operates directly on them. And neither is obviously the most dangerous because you're operating directly on user memory, which the user land application can control. The other thing that they cover in the background information is ALPC, or Advanced Local Procedure Calling, which is Windows' high-performance IPC mechanism. And the main thing you need to be aware of there is the fact that you can use something called I/O completion ports for processing asynchronous I/O requests. And those ALPC syscalls can be invoked directly and are usually accessible anywhere, even though it's technically an undocumented API and it's not something you're supposed to use directly. But you can do it. It's not blocked off. So that's another important thing to cover there. So, yeah. With that said, we'll get into some of the issues.
The ALPC thing, like, that's kind of common when it comes to Windows, just undocumented but publicly accessible syscalls. I guess jumping into one of the issues, though, as we're just talking about the advanced local procedure call, undocumented API for the APC, you're expected to use some higher level interfaces, essentially. But the issue that happens is kind of predictable in that when you're creating kind of the ALPC port, you're able to determine where your received messages are going to go. So any other process that sends you a message, you can decide that you're going to use shared memory to receive those messages, and that just means like you and the kernel will both share that bit of memory. And so during the allocation process, so kernel gets this message, it might get it from user, copies it, whatever it does, it's going to write it into your address space and that shared, well, it's going to write it into that shared memory, assuming that's the method you've chosen. So it'll allocate a little bit of space in that shared memory and it'll copy in the header and body. And then there are also attributes with that message that need to be copied in. Those get stored kind of immediately after the body. And it calculates where to store those by looking back at the header. So in your application, you can basically watch for the kernel to start writing and to write that initial header, change the value before it actually goes back to figure out where to write the attributes, and race it on that time of check, time of use type of issue. And that was kind of the first bug, and we're going to see a lot of those sorts of bugs in here. One of the other things, when it comes to how the socket ioctl calls kind of get handled, if you're not too familiar, there are kind of a few things to be aware of. Just pulling up a graph on screen. So, user mode, you're using WinSoc, and generally speaking, that's going to communicate with this AFD interface, or AFD.sys. That ends up making the call down into the TCP IP stack itself. But in the kernel, you could also, or there also exists the WinSoc kernel, which is the WSK on this graph, and TDI, which is the transfer driver interface. Those two interfaces also kind of exist, WinSoc kernel being a little bit newer, and all of them essentially make their way just to the normal TCP IP stack. TDI is kind of the legacy interface from, I believe, pre-Vista days. And that just basically has the TDX, which will translate whatever comes in through TDI into the actual TCP IP stack. So with kind of that in mind and how there's these different ways of accessing the TCP IP stack itself, AFD being the normal one does some validation on your incoming ioctl calls. Kind of does some of the expected things, so make sure you're using the right type, like if you're accessing one of the SOL underscore variables, you should be using like get or set sock opt as your way of doing that, not making an ioctl call. And basically your ioctls have several different types. One of those types of interest here is Type Zero, which is an internal. It'll reject everything. Nobody should be able to call that from outside. So AFD will check that as the request comes in. And AFD is the only thing you really have direct access to. You can't directly make any calls that will get you a handle into the TDI or WinSock kernel. Those are both in the kernel side to use those interfaces. So one of the main bugs that they found was using the basically write flags. They go into a little bit more details. Like, you could get, when a socket's created with some transport name actually specified, a TDX handle will end up being created for it, and you can query that using AFD's query handles. So, kind of with the write flags, and I believe they only really just say on that page, it's you need the write flags, but don't indicate what those flags were. It'll return you that TDX handle. And the problem there being that the TDX interface does not perform that same validation. So you're able to effectively make all of these internal ioctl calls without passing through any validation, or you get access to a lot of new calls. So that bug kind of led to most of the bugs that are in this paper.
It opens up a huge attack surface.
Yeah, that's kind of the key thing. Like, what it did is it just opened up this whole attack surface, this whole new area that had not been really examined before and wasn't really expected to receive untrusted input. So four of the bugs were effectively just vulnerabilities by calling into these functions. So one of them, a socket query security descriptor info leak. Basically, they just called in this internal ioctl, code 0x20. It just returns a kernel pointer to the security descriptor in the output buffer directly back to the user in this case. Or another one, code 0x18. It would replace the particular address's security descriptor with an arbitrary pointer that you would provide, and then it would increment it so you can get an arbitrary kernel increment from that. Third one was in associate quality of service, using kind of the internal code SIO reserved _1. I'm not sure what value that resolves to, but again, using that, for that one, AFD should be performing kind of some message translation between how user line's going to be sending it versus what it actually expects. That doesn't happen when you're just invoking these directly. It hits this function PCP validate in reference flow, which reads an arbitrary object pointer and does another increment on that to increment the reference counter. Similarly, on set quality of service, which is SIO _set_QoS, again, no translation on that one. Struct gets mapped from user mode this time in a slightly different function. The struct gets mapped from user mode, and you can basically change the size between a read and its actual allocation and copying of that data. So that time you get erase. And then the last vulnerability is another erase. It doesn't take advantage of the socket ioctl validation that we were just talking about, that all of the previous bugs, except for the very first one, took advantage of. This one is in the multicast filter. And it's just kind of your normal ioctl socket, normal ioctl. What it does, it'll map this group filter structure from shared memory, from user mode into shared memory. And it does some length validation on a number indicating basically how many IP addresses are being included, uses that number to allocate a numpage pool buffer. And once again, you can it will read that value again after the actual allocation in order to copy it. You can change it after the initial allocation to something larger and get your overflow that way. It's another talk to issue.
too many talk tos.
I mean, there were only, well, I'm saying only, but then it's like 3 or 4 here, so yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it's a lot of similar issues, and a number of them are just because of that validation bypass that opens up a ton of attack surface.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big one.
Yeah, like, that half of these vulnerabilities just relied on bypassing that validation.
Yeah, hitting code that was never expected to be directly callable like that.
Which is a great find, and I will mention, I want to mention this at the top, but forgot. When I first saw the page for this, these Black Swan vulnerabilities, and I saw, so you had to fill out your email, no, this one didn't have the email link, but you still had to go through like the extra hassle of actually downloading this PDF. They didn't have any good summaries on their initial page. I was expecting like this big marketing document and just not a very good write-up, but this is actually a well-done write-up. A lot of the summaries, like if you were to just try and scan this and look at the vulnerability pages directly, you can get a pretty good summary from that without really understanding all the background. But they, of course, provide plenty of background in it. Honestly, it's really well done. I was expecting worse, given some of the other PDFs like this that we've covered. No, I mean, some interesting vulnerabilities on a whole.
Another thing I wanted to call out is towards pages 32 and onwards, they also talk about how these issues can be reliably exploited, covering some peep grooming strategies and how they exploited the arbitrary increment in the page pool, for example. Now, I won't really like talk about that on the podcast, and I haven't read all of it, but that's just something that you don't always see. Like, it not only does it have the background information and like good explanations of the issues, it also has a good explanation of the exploit side of things, which was really cool. The only thing I wish was that this wasn't a PDF. I don't like the PDF format for these kinds of technical write-ups because it just really sucks for like navigating and searching around. The PDF itself is awesome. Like you were saying, it was a lot better than I was expecting. But like, if this was just a single page or something, I would have liked it. It would have been so much nicer to read through. But, you know, I guess people still like their PDFs for some things. So,
yeah, I mean,
it's just a format critique. That's all.
You can definitely make it look a lot more, I guess, slick when you're using a PDF.
At the expense of like being slow, because there was a lot of times where I was trying to jump back and forth when I was looking at an issue and I was like, oh wait, let me look at this background again, and it's like, oh boy, I'm just sitting there for like 15 seconds waiting for the page to load. I'm like, god damn, I hate PDFs.
Yeah, but no, I had the exact same experience. One question out of chat from Sarsec, I know I butchered that. Random side question, are there any applications that make these kind of graphics and visuals? I mean, yeah, there's various, I think one of the terms you'd probably want to look up is like mind mapping, you know, these sorts of graphs coming out of it. I mean, Visio comes to mind. We actually had a discussion in the Discord a while back about more XKDC style graphs, or it kind of went in that direction, at least. It was those that kind of look like they're hand-drawn, which reminds me of XKCD style things, but we talked a little bit about that. There's a lot of applications that make graphs. I don't know what they actually use for these, but it's a fairly common thing to have, yeah.
Yeah. The final point I'll hit on is, because I kind of forgot to mention this earlier, the exploitation techniques they mention, those actually work on Windows 10, 19H1 and later, which is worth calling out because I've seen some Windows vulnerabilities before where the blog post will cover how it could be exploited, but it's like how it could be exploited on Windows 7 or something, because Microsoft does put a lot of effort in every OS release to mitigate the common techniques for taking advantage of vulnerabilities. And you don't see too much that really works on like modern Windows. So that's another thing that just makes the like exploitation section that much more worth it, is the fact that it works on modern Windows, Windows 10 as well. So,
yeah, I mean, yeah. The challenge there is Windows is always introducing like these little mitigations that just fix like some exploit technique that's gotten a little bit popular. They'll start protecting that structure or something, and that's what makes it hard to always keep up. You know, you have a vulnerability, it's probably exploitable, but you have to kind of keep on top of what all the techniques are and strategies are with Windows.
Yeah, Microsoft is really good at making exploitation annoying on Windows.
Yeah.
All right, we do have one more Windows issue, which is a symbolic link race condition. Z, I know you found this one interesting, so I'll let you take this one away.
I wasn't expecting to take this one, actually. I was expecting to take the last one, which I hijacked from you. Symbolic link issue, like I said, wasn't expecting to take this one over.
So, sorry, I must have got it mixed up in my head, because I thought you really liked that one, so I must have confused the two. So I can take this one. So, yeah, it's a race condition between these two different syscalls in NT, right? To manage symbolic links, they have these two syscalls. OBP create symbolic link name, and OBP delete symbolic link name. And the specific problem there is the create system call will create a handle for the user before the symbolic link object actually is finished being initialized. So it can be manipulated by like the OBP delete symbolic name syscall while create is still using it. So you have this kind of interesting race where if you get other threads to perform like a delete call, you can abuse these kind of double fetches. I don't really want to call them double fetches because the structure is in kernel controlled memory. But because of the way they operate on it, like on some fields, for example, they directly assign into those fields and then re-reference those fields later. They don't have like a cached copy on the stack. So because of that design pattern, presumably because they weren't expecting to have like anyone else to have a handle at this point, you can abuse these field accesses in a racy way so that a negative array access happens.
Since you bring up the terminology double fetch there, like I would kind of agree with you there that it feels like, you know, double fetch is kind of, if you're trying to understand what the issue is, it's an apt description of it. Say like, okay, you know, it fetches it because that's generally the vulnerability you have where somebody else can edit it. But I think more generally, probably just called some like insufficient locking, really. Because that's ultimately what it is. It's just the fact that the object can be modified out from under it rather than kind of a double fetch, which still allows that same primitive, but the root cause is a bit different.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So, yeah, like later on, they use this field, DOS device driver index, which is used to index into the array in the create syscall. Basically, how they calculate that is they take the drive letter and they subtract hex 40 into that, and then they pull it out again and subtract 1 before doing the table lookup. But the delete system call can run and swap out that device driver index for something like 0. So when that decrement happens, you have an array access at -1, which is obviously out of bounds. Further, because you can control that drive type in the delete call, you can also control what's being written out of bounds. So I don't know how exploitable that would be. It is a little bit constrained by the fact that I don't think you could access much further beyond -1 because it is just like that straightforward decrement. I don't think you can pass anything lower than 0 in the delete syscall. That said, it probably could be taken advantage of just because when you're dealing with kernel and the heap, well, on Windows, it's a little bit different, too, because they structure like page pools, non-page pools, stuff differently. But I would imagine there's a world where you could take advantage of this in some way, shape, or form. That said, I'm not really familiar enough with Windows to comment on that confidently. But yeah, I mean, nonetheless, it's an interesting bug. And I will say, like, as far as races go, this kind of race where you have like one syscall or one function that's initializing an object but doesn't hold the lock where something else can come in and use it before it's fully initialized, not really that uncommon as far as races go. It can be tricky to manage like object lifetimes when you have to deal with like concurrency. So
yeah, I mean, yeah, the something key thing to here look out for. Actually isn't exactly like, if I were thinking about mitigating this or fixing it, I'd be thinking kind of along the lines of it shouldn't be exposing that handle until it's actually finished. Initializing the object rather than necessarily going with insufficient locking, as I was saying earlier. I mean, usually you would expect, like, you expose it after you finish everything with it. So maybe a little bit of just out of order operations, out of the expected order. But yeah, exploiting it's an interesting question. Because yeah, it is that negative one access, so it is out of bounds. It's, you know, it's always, it's going to completely depend on what's there.
It's going to depend on how you can shape the heat. Yeah.
That's yeah, like, and it's going to depend on, so maybe there is another route here that isn't depending on the delete object also. That's obviously the route that they found for using it at that point, but there might be something else, some other attack that you can go there, but you'd have to do the RE for that.
Yeah. And to answer Blika's question, is there a POC for anything else other than a blue screen? I haven't seen one. There might be one out there, but I didn't do too much looking either. But the POCs that I've seen have just been for like a blue screen. But yeah, I mean, always nice to see races. So yeah, we love races on this show. All right, so we'll move into some of our WebKit bugs. We have two of them, although there were a lot more that were released last week by Project Zero. We decided to cover the two that we found most interesting. The first one here is a root cause analysis posted by Maddie Stone at Project Zero. These bugs have been getting a lot of attention from the console scenes this week as well, because it was discovered that these do indeed cause crashes on the PS4 and even on the PS5 and likely some other consoles as well. And that's mainly because they're in JavaScript core, which is amazing because pretty much every browser bug that we've covered this year has been like in an optimizer or turbofan or something like that. It's just like it's been a long time, it feels, since I've seen a bug in like JavaScript core or HTML. Like those kinds of bugs they seem to be extinct for a while. But you know, obviously they're not, because there are a bunch of them that drop from P0 this week. So this first one here is use after free, although that term is used a little bit loosely. I think we'll get into that discussion in a little bit, but it's a UAF when removing fonts from the font faces lookup table in CSS. Amazingly simple POC. It's just three lines. You know, Maddie was saying she loves tweetable bugs. Basically, what's happening there is when it goes to remove a font face from a face set lookup table, it'll iterate the table to remove them, and it will assert that the iterator doesn't equal the like end of the table. Asserts don't do anything in release builds. It's kind of that same thing that we've seen a couple times before. So if you do something like create an invalid font face, create a set that uses it, it'll attempt to remove the font from the table, even though no font was even added, because you can't add an invalid font to the table to begin with. So that leads to this kind of UAF situation. I think an out of bounds access is maybe a bit more apt. Because mainly what the issue is here is that the iterator is going beyond the end of the table and accessing stale memory. So it is a use after free a bit in how it works, but the root cause there is the fact that it's accessing out of bounds of the table.
Yeah,
so I mean, you can kind of go either way with it, I guess.
But that's kind of the thing. Like, your root cause is the whole fact that just when you're using the iterator, it'll find, if it doesn't find the result, it's going to point to dot end, or end if you wrap it in that functional too. It'll point to the end, which is basically the pointer immediately adjacent to the last value in memory. So if you've removed an object, had something maybe removed a little bit earlier or something, that's going to be some sort of dead memory in there that shouldn't really be accessed. So it is kind of the use after free. But as you're saying, it's caused by just the fact that it's accessing out of bounds, given how .find returns the end pointer rather than, say, null or something like that.
So part of the reason I brought that up is because someone on Twitter, Wololo actually, they're like a news site, but they asked, like, where's the free happening? And that kind of prompted me to think about it, like, because the issue here, there's not something directly getting freed. Like, it's not like it's taking an error path and it's freeing something and then it's being used again, right? Like your classic UAF. So that kind of made me think, like, the use after free is a little bit confusing as a classifier. Because if you're trying to look for what you would typically associate with a UAF, you're not really going to find it in that code. So, yeah, bit of an interesting discussion. I wouldn't fault them, though, for classifying it as a use after free. I think you can go either way. Personally, I would just go with, like, an out-of-bounds access.
But, I guess the other thing is that does kind of depend on end. And I'm not sure if the operation of end is actually determined by the C++ standard or not. I mean, this is part of the C++ standard library, the iterator, and basically, you know, all the standard library containers will have this iterator on them. I'm not sure if the standard actually specifies that end needs to point to the memory immediately following it, or if end can return something else. I mean, there are things like if table's empty, I know begin and end both have to point to the same place, and there are some certain associations like that, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure if this is relying on a particular implementation of C++, or if this would just generically be an issue.
Yeah, you'd have to really go diving through the source code to see, like, how it's implemented.
Or reading the spec. Really, I mean, it might be in the spec.
Yeah, I mean, that's even worse. I think I'd rather go diving through the source code than read the C++ specification, so. But yeah, I mean, basically the issue there is really simple. It's just the assert needed to be changed to, like, a proper if statement check. That said, exploitation, I'm not really sure how easy this would be. I don't see anything that immediately jumps out as, like, a good corruption logic here. I don't know if maybe you could do something with, like, the value remove call on the iterator, but yeah, this seems a little bit tough to take advantage of if you're trying to exploit it. I'm not really sure how you would. I'd have to do some, like, live tinkering with it and, like, run a debugger and see what I can do to comment definitively on, like, how exploitable this is. But just with the limited amount that I have done with browser exploitation and looking at corruption logic, this one looks tough to take advantage of. And the Project Zero RCA there even says that they have no exploit sample to determine the exploitability. So this wasn't something, I mean, it is in the Zero Days in the Wild series, but this didn't seem to be found in the wild since they don't have a sample. But
well, not having a sample, I don't think means that they don't, that it wasn't still found being exploited in the wild. It could just be that they have a crash. Like, you know, a phone log shows a crash here type deal. And that's why they don't have an exploit sample, because it's just not available to them. There could be a number of reasons for that. They did find this in the wild, so, like, there must have been some way to exploit it. And it's really coming down to what level of control you're able to get over that memory after it. Because, I mean, you get there, B tables, you get some sort of access. I have to imagine, well, I'd basically just end with saying we know it was exploitable because this was an in the wild bug. But yeah, I mean, they don't provide us any of that exploitation detail.
We're making that assumption that it's on the Zero Days in the Wild blog, which I guess that is, like, their intent, like, in their about, they state that it's for detailing bugs that were found in the wild, but reading through it, it didn't seem to indicate that they'd found it in the wild, just because of the way that, like, they say they don't have a sample, and yes, you're right, like, it could just be that they got a crash from a failed exploit attempt or something like that, but then also having, like, the exact trigger and finding the POC, if they did find it in the wild, they did, like, solid root causing here to be able to reconstruct the POC like that. So, it could have been found in the wild. I didn't really see anything that indicated that, but I mean, it is the in the wild blog. So,
yeah, I just pulled up the
I guess that's a fair assumption.
The tracker, And looks like they don't have a date discovered for it. They have a date patched and a link to the advisory for it. They don't have an analysis, just the root cause, and they don't have who it was reported by.
Yeah, so that does seem really weird that they don't have like a date discovered, but that seems to be pretty
that table. That happens in the table. There's points of that. Like, all of these things are missing in other reports, too. This isn't, like, the first time we're seeing that. But yeah, I mean, I am making that assumption. I mean, the fact that
it's a fair assumption to make, I think.
So. Like, we have a dereferencing whatever the iterator is. Like, dereference on that access relative to it, at least, you know, iterating on that size return function calls based off of it. I do feel like it would be exploited. Like, just looking at this myself, I don't see, like, the exact way you target that, but at the same time, I see enough operations happening on that iterator, which will be pointing to bad data, that a route there does seem pretty feasible to me.
For the most part, it's reads, though. Like, how many times you're iterating in a loop with the value size. There is the value remove, which I kind of called out earlier as maybe a potential route, but yeah, I mean, you'd have to do some digging to
determine
one way or the other.
It is reads, but you do see it calling like the potential functions on it also, like the dot pointer dot size. So that you should be able to gain some degree of control of, like from the V tables.
Yeah.
So that's kind of at least my thought there. If it is mostly on the read side, even that, like, this could just be one bug of the chain. Again, without any real information about the scenario in which it was caught, perhaps this isn't the only bug you need. I wonder what the advisory indicates, like if it indicates that it was... if it indicates whether or not this was code execution or if it was something else.
Oh, that's a good shout. Yeah. I mean, I will say, like, if somebody does take the time to look at this and manages to exploit it, I would be very interested to see how. I don't want to say that exploitability is not possible here because I just don't know enough about the area. And I've always kind of said this with browsers, but, like, there's so many things you can get control of when in the browser heap, and there's so much damage you can do if there's like even a very small memory corruption. So it wouldn't surprise me if this could be exploited. I would just be curious on how it could be done.
That said, it does look like this, even on Apple, saying is an anonymous researcher reported it, but they do indicate maliciously crafted web content may lead to arbitrary code execution. So at the very least,
a report that it may have been actively exploited too. So that kind of hits more towards the side of it being exploitable. So
yeah.
I did want to take something out of chat. Sarsec suggested like maybe they got it from telemetry data from someone fuzzing it. That would be pretty funny actually. And I guess it's totally possible. Like somebody's just running a fuzzing setup carelessly, isolated or whatever. I mean, I guess it's possible that those could make it back to P0.
I feel like you might be a little bit biased on that. Just having done the PS4 research, being concerned about Sony patching your ODAs. At the same time,
maybe.
I do feel like, you know, a more, fuzzing WebKit, you don't necessarily need to hide that telemetry. Like, I mean, maybe, depending on how you're going to use that, but at least some researchers would not need to, so.
Yeah, I mean, it was a half joke, as he points out in chat, but I mean, it is an interesting point to bring up, too. Like, it is somewhat possible, but I would believe it. Yeah,
like, that's where I put it. Like,
I believe it, but I don't think that's what happened here.
Yeah, no, I don't either, but would be funny, and I would definitely believe that Apple, also Google with Chrome, would be watching for such things. It is a bug report, after all.
It's in their best interest. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll get into our next WebKit bug, which is another use after free, this time in DOM window open. And the problem here is whenever the function, this function, DOM window open, receives the frame name of underscore top or underscore parent, which is like one of the special identifiers for specifying an immediate location change, it'll do a lookup for the frame object, store a pointer to it, and then schedule a location change and access that pointer again to return it to the window proxy. Well, depending on how that URL is structured, that schedule location change function can either be invoked synchronously or asynchronously. The change will be asynchronous if the new URL is the same as the old one, unless the URL fragments at the end are changed. If they are, then it'll be a synchronous change.
Sorry. What will happen is that it will normally... as an asynchronous change. What that means, schedule location change basically returns immediately, and that raw pointer, no chance anything's really happened to it yet. But if it's only making a fragment change, so it's not actually changing like the whole page, it's not navigating anywhere new, it's just the fragment of the page, then it gets performed synchronously, as you were saying.
Yeah.
Fires off the pop state JavaScript event, and an attacker can basically destroy the frame there. That's all performed, or that'll end up being performed synchronously, leading to the dangling pointer.
Yeah, I did get it mixed up there, because I initially had that in like the first bit of notes I wrote, and then I corrected it, but I didn't correct it in the like notes that I was referencing now. So fair enough, that was my bad. Like you were saying, it's the synchronous call of that event handler that can be dangerous. So yeah, by just defining an event handler that'll destroy the iframe, you can get the UAF on it. Getting use after free on iframe, by the way, this issue seemed like I would be way more confident in trying to exploit this issue than I would be the last one. Now, it wouldn't be an immediate win, because the like iframe objects are allocated in the web core heap. For those not too familiar with like the WebKit heap and how it works, they have these heap arenas where they'll allocate objects in different arenas. So like HTML elements and iframes and stuff like that, those will typically go in the web core arena. And then butterflies for things like objects with properties and values and stuff, those will be allocated in a different heap, like the JS core heap. So in order to exploit this and do something useful with it, you would have to cross that boundary of going from like web core heap corruption to JS core heap corruption. Although that's not like super hard to do, because there are other objects you can like overlap in the web core heap that are useful, like array buffers and stuff. So I think you could fairly easily take advantage of this if I'm reading it right. The only thing I'm not 100% sure of is you have the use after free in this function, like when it goes to return the target frame window proxy, that's done in a UAF state. I don't know if you keep the UAF state on the JavaScript side, and it's kind of significant, because if you do, I think this would be relatively trivial as far as browser exploits go to take advantage of it. If you only have the UAF in that like somewhat brief window and you can only do something with the window proxy, it gets more difficult. But I think given the type of object that an iframe is, I think it still could be exploited. It would just be, I just have to figure out like how that could be exploited, because it's more of a specific situation to the functions involved. So yeah, I mean, if we had to compare this issue and the last issue, I think this one is more promising as an attacker. I don't know if I'll play around with this bug. I kind of want to, because I do love doing browser exploitation. I learn a lot when I do it. The last time I wrote a WebKit exploit was really fun. That said, it also took a lot of time. I had to do a lot of debugging and learning. It was probably like a week of solid like grinding on it. So I don't know if I can really put that kind of time in this or like dedication into something like this right now, but maybe I'll take a look at it and see if it can be exploited. If not, I'm sure there's others out there who will take pleasure in trying to exploit these issues, because it's just a really good exercise if you're looking for something to do and like a really solid modern hardened target to try to exploit. Like if you're looking to get into exploit dev, something like this is like the perfect thing for you to do. Just taking like a known bug and see if you can exploit it, hammer away at it in a debugger and see what you can make happen. It was probably like one of the most fun exploits I've written, was doing something like that. So yeah. But yeah, that's all we have on the exploit side of things. We'll move into some of the research that we have. We have a post from Maxwell Doolin. It's an update on the House of IO heap exploitation techniques. So these were dropped last year. It mainly talks about abusing the tcache or the per thread cache in glibc and attacking the metadata there to obtain a powerful primitive, like the ability to return arbitrary addresses from malloc.
So the key thing those here, though,
build up to that.
Sorry, the key part of why, you know, just last year-ish is because, you know, this is really about bypassing safe linking, which is a mitigation that was introduced with a default allocator for glibc in 2.32. And safe linking kind, I'll relate it a little bit to like an encrypted pointer. Effectively, it would XOR part of the pointer. It would basically mask pointers with the computation based on the address at which the pointer was being stored. So this is being used to protect the singly list or singly linked list, such as those like you know the free list, effectively, or multiple free lists. But it would basically just, you know, take the randomization you get with ASLR, those upper bits, shift them down, XOR the later bit with it. The intent being, you know, to protect against cases where the attacker has a linear overflow or a relative arbitrary write, and just take away kind of that common strategy of taking advantage of those the forward pointers in the singly linked list. House of IO was kind of a limited break of that, where you would obtain kind of a malloc-ware sort of primitive. So you could control where one of the next allocations would come from of a particular size. You'd control where that would end up getting placed, and then, you know, away you go from there. There were a few different tricks to House of IO. Two of them kind of focusing on the thread specific values, which kind of is where thread cache comes in, or tcache. The key field there is a basically unprotected pointer. It's used as part of the double free, and it's just a pointer to the per thread structure. So two of the attacks, so if you had a use after free, so in order to use this strategy, you would need either use after free, that's act dereferencing and accessing or writing at an 8-byte offset. Feasible, but you need that particular setup for it. The other option is if you had a arbitrary free, you could free and obviously able to leak some memory. A lot of these still rely on some knowledge, perhaps. But you could free the pcache, pthread structure, per thread structure itself also. Those being kind of two of the house file. The other one was an underflow. So this per thread structure, yes, one important aspect of that is it stores pointers to the singly linked list, and those are also not protected. This is meant to kind of protect those in heap, like the forward pointer. So the star ones to the head of the list are not protected there, and that exists in that tcache per thread structure. So if you could underflow, so that is right before a particular buffer, and have some control over that, you could actually access the tcache per thread structure. So that is usually going to exist really early on in the heap or within your particular arena. I keep tossing out with like tcache stuff. So that is a per thread thing. Every thread will get its own little heap arena where everything else follows, and this structure will be at the start of that, so a relatively low address. So that structure, you'd need some primitive that gives you that relative access all the way back there to write, or, like I said, the underflow. Relative access with negative numbers is... we've seen it. I guess we were also even talking about one a little bit earlier where it decrements. So we've seen that sort of primitive. Although that minus one wouldn't work here, ignoring the fact that it's Windows and all that. You need more than that, but not super common. And the other one being an underflow, again, it's not a super common. You'll see the overflow more often than an actual underflow, but it does exist. So finally getting to Maxwell Dolan here and his post is another route of attacking that pcache per thread structure, which is a little bit more likely of a scenario to end up in. So what this one does, heap reuse. The problem being the tcache creates a structure, like I said, for every thread, unless there's too many threads. If you have too many threads, it will start to share those arenas. So you can end up having this tcache thing. Instead of it being allocated at like the top of the arena, it will end up being just a random chunk in the middle of it. If you're able to get enough threads using it to basically cause this, and I believe it was 8 times the number of CPU cores as like the default value. It can be modified, it's configurable. I think there's even an environment variable that can be used to configure that, but effectively have a bunch of threads and it'll end up just being a chunk on the heap. So with that, with a little bit of heap feng shui or a coercion there, you would be able to overflow into it instead of only having the underflow primitive, which is largely what it ends up talking about here. And this post gives a lot of background. We have talked a little bit about, so we talked about safe linking back around when it was getting introduced on episode 43. And we are covering a different blog post, and just for kind of a little bit more background on House of IO, same author has another post elsewhere about safe linking, and House of IO is the attack there. That said, the blog here also covers a good amount of detail on that too. I did kind of prefer that second link for background on House of IO, but he, you know, does a completely fair job here too. But yeah, kind of goes into that detail, just an improved primitive. If you have some sort of exploit on the heap, this makes it at least possible for an overflow to get there rather than relying on the more unlikely primitives.
Yeah, so the main idea there is just removing that kind of assumption that you have to make that the tcache struct object is going to be at the lower addresses in the heap. So by kind of breaking that assumption, that it's like the first allocation, that reopens the ability to do overflows. You are kind of doing a bit of a trade-off there, because while you now can use like overflows, you do need the ability to be able to spawn a lot of threads, right? And it kind of points that out in the pros and cons section. That is somewhat of a high ask, that you can just like spin up an arbitrary number of threads like that to it be is, able to force the arena consolidation or the arena sharing. But
yeah, I mean, it is a bit more of an ask in one sense, but it enables exploitation with more vulnerabilities. So I think I think the trade-off is worth it. Yeah, like it's easier, I think. I'd maybe struggle to make that like an objective statement, but my hunch is, you know, that's going to be more common to be able to spin up more threads. There are, you know, definitely some cases where that wouldn't be the case. But for a lot of large applications, that feels reasonable. And it opens up overflows to being able to attack this, or to get around the safe linking.
Yeah, I think generally you'll end up in situations more often where you can spawn like the number of threads necessary to use this than you would be like expecting an underflow. Because like you were saying, like those are pretty uncommon bugs. Because a lot of the time, like even if you get that negative array indexing or something, it's often like the one we covered today where it's like -1 or -2. Like it's not like you're going super far outside of your relative right. So having to go back to the beginning of the heap or like the lower addresses is a high ask there. So that's why, like I think it's worth it, the trade-off.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, ultimately it's another option here. It's not like you have to go this route if you want to deal with SafeLink. You have the other options. This is just furthering the research there.
Yeah. So very cool post overall.
And I'll shout out also that he did a workshop actually on heap exploitation at DEF CON. I'm not sure if he'll be continuing that, but I have heard some good reports from some people I've known that did attend it. So just a little shout out on that.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I am a little bit surprised because I thought we covered House of IO back when it happened, because that was posted back in, I think, July of 2020. But I guess where we were on the break, we just didn't cover it when we came back.
Yeah, no, so, we talked about episode 43. We talked about safe linking, but not House of IO.
Yeah, so that's probably what I was confusing, because I know we talked about like glibc and thread cache, hitting the thread cache before. But yeah, it must have been in the context of episode 43, which that was a good while ago. So.
But yeah, no, I was thinking the same. I thought I remembered actually covering this before, or like House of IO, but when I looked into it, I don't believe we did.
Maybe we saw it and read it, but we just didn't cover it on the podcast or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. Deja vu type stuff. Anyway, that's pretty much all the hard topics we have for the episode. Z, I know you did have one shout out, so I'll let you get to that, and then we'll move to wrapping up the show.
Yeah, I had one shout out here. I just saw this earlier today. It is a little bit older, but getting started in macOS security. I saw this linked on Discord. Unfortunately, not our Day Zero Discord, but it's just a number of links for getting started. So, you know, references the macOS kernel internals book.
Getting some courses. Started in macOS specifically, just clarify.
Yeah, I mean, it's just macOS specific resources. Even shouts out Offensive Security has a new course out, only available with their new kind of subscription plan, on dealing with macOS security. Just a bunch of resources to check out. A number of blogs are linked at the end there, which are definitely worth taking a look at. So I just want to at least leave it as a shout out here.
All right, cool. So that pretty much concludes the show. Thank you to everyone who tuned in. You can catch the VOD on Twitch or on YouTube at 6 p.m. Eastern tomorrow. We also have previous podcasts up on some other platforms like Spotify, Apple Podcast, and more links on Anchor. Feel free to join our Discord and follow us on Twitter. Links for those are below the video. I'll also put the Discord in chat. We usually have some cool discussions in Discord. And, you know, like Z was saying, like, we kind of have links and stuff floating around in there too. So, you know, if you're interested in that, go ahead and join us there. We'll also put out any alerts of when we're live and stuff on both the Discord and Twitter. But yeah, with that said, we'll be back next Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific for the Bounty episode. And next Tuesday at the same time as today, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific for Binary. And we'll see you all then.